You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Alex tōku ingoa, no mai haere mai, ki o te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Ratu Tuesday. I'm your host Alex and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in studio by producer Liam. E whai ake nei coming up on the show. For Dear Science this week, our expert, Professor Alan Blackman, speaks with us about molecules on Mars, Schrodinger's cat, and the link between learning and living a longer life. For our weekly catch-up with the National Party, I spoke with Ryan Hamilton about the derogatory comments made last week by NZ First Minister Shane Jones and other barbs traded between Winston Peters and the Prime Minister and Finance Minister, the Treasury revisiting forecasts for the budget, and changes to infrastructure oversight. And Thursday Wire host Caden spoke to Benjamin Law from the University of Auckland about an email he mistakenly sent to all undergraduate students. Liam, what do you have for us today?
I spoke with Scott Burnett, Regional Conservation Manager for the top of the South Island and Forest and Birds Climate Spokesperson, about the Climate Change Commission's recent advice to the government that the emissions trading scheme was in a precarious state and in need of reform, what the consequences of the government's current approach are for New Zealand, and what can be done to improve the situation.
He aha o whakaaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or waiamai rāne, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Kaua e ware ware e ahe ana koutou, te whakarongo ke ene kōrero āno, hei pakehere roki roki mā runga i te pai, tukutuku o Irirangi Poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast or on the podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Kia te mata te whakatūranga, let's get on to the show.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
For Dear Science today, we are joined by our expert, Professor Alan Blackman. How are we today?
Oh, we're good, actually. It's beautiful out there. Very nice. Nice and warm.
A lot warmer than it was when I came in this morning, and I've just started to completely regret it. But, hey, look, warmth is good.
Absolutely, yeah.
What has science got for us today?
Oh, science has always got something for us today. So today, we're going to talk about the question that one David Jones, a.k.a. David Bowie, first postulated way back in, oh gosh, when was that, 69, 70, 71? Life on Mars. Is there life on Mars? And that's obviously not a question that he was the first to ask. This goes back quite some time, little green men and all of that sort of stuff. But there's been a big discovery made on Mars, and this discovery was actually started, let's say, 6 years ago. And it all started with the good old Mars rover, Curiosity,
that we all know and love,
driving around there. It's just absolutely astonishing. Just, you know, blows my mind that we can do this. This is amazing stuff. So way back in 2020, Curiosity drilled a hole in a Martian rock, and what it then did was analyze what was present in that rock. Okay, and that is not a simple feat, honestly. So Curiosity, in addition to being able to drive around and take photos and, you know, do this, that and everything, also has got a miniature chemistry lab on board, and which is, you know, just incredible. So what they have are the instruments that we would use in the laboratories here on planet Earth to do analysis of samples to find out what elements, what molecules, what compounds are present in particular samples. And of course, obviously, what we're looking for on Mars is molecules of life. And the molecules of life generally contain carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, and oxygen, and on very rare occasions, some sulfur as well, okay? And so, you know, obviously, if we were to come across such molecules on Mars, it might be a pointer, to the fact that life perhaps once did exist on Mars but doesn't anymore, or who knows what lies beneath the surface, you know? And so basically what they're looking for are what we call organic molecules. So organic molecules are molecules that contain carbon, essentially. So they're composed primarily of carbon. And as I say, normally hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen as well. So those are the organic molecules of life, shall we say. Okay, and those two latter ones are really important, the nitrogen and the oxygen. Those are the ones that are required for life. Just carbon and hydrogen by itself, they're not.
Oh, yeah, that's just...
They're not. Okay. So what happened was that Curiosity found 21 organic molecules in this sample that it drilled out, and 7 of those were detected for the first time on Mars, which is kind of cool. And now, obviously, what we don't know is how these were created, okay? So there are biological methods by which these could have been created, which would be very interesting. There are geological methods by which these could be created, which will be interesting to the geologists.
But life on Mars.
But absolutely less cool, shall we say. Less cool. Now, why were they drilling in rocks? Well, this is kind of interesting because Mars doesn't really have an atmosphere, so it's not shielded so much from the high energy particles in the sun's rays as we are, thank goodness. And because of that, then molecules can be broken down on the surface of Mars much more easily than they can on planet Earth due to this excessive radiation. And so, therefore, if we are drilling down into rocks and stuff like that, then they're shielded from that radiation. And, you know, the molecules that we find are much more likely to have been in the state that they were when they were created, shall we say. So, for those of you with a chemistry bent, what they found was trimethylbenzene, tetramethylbenzene, methylbenzoate, dihydronaphthalene, naphthalene, benzothiophene, and methyl naphthalene. There you go.
That's a lot of benes and lenes.
Indeed it is. And so all of these are what we would call hydrocarbons, which means they just contain carbon and hydrogen. They're organic molecules containing carbon and hydrogen. But the benzothiophene was interesting because that's got sulfur in it. But the real excitement seems to come from one of the molecules that they couldn't quite absolutely confirm the identity of, but they're pretty darn sure that this is what it is. And they've found what we call a heterocyclic molecule and an N-heterocyclic molecule. Now, what that is a ring of carbon atoms that also contains a nitrogen. Okay, so... And the reason that they're interested in this is that our DNA and our RNA, now, so these contain such molecules, so such cyclic molecules that contain both carbon and nitrogen. So they're starting to get a little bit excited about this. And so they've just published this month. As I said, they took the sample in 2020 and it's taken this long to analyze it. As I say, it's not a simple matter.
Yeah.
You know, it really is quite astonishing what they can do there. the beauty of this is that they're using gas chromatographs and mass spectrometers, okay, which chemists will know what I mean by those. But these have been made by particular companies, and so when they published the paper, they did sort of mention that, oh, you know, this is a GC made by so and so. So these people have just got brilliant advertising now out of this. Oh, you know, our our machines have been used on Mars. You know, yeah. So I think that's a really, really, really good selling point. So yeah, so this is quite exciting stuff. The search will continue until. Oh, they probably will find something, I guess. That's my feeling, my gut feeling anyway. So
there's just like, I mean, I'm not a tech and science guy, but like there's just something so amazing about like thinking about, you know, how that rover is just doing things.
Yes.
It's sitting there and it's just doing things.
Yep.
And
Yep.
Hey.
And it's, you know, like 50 million kilometers away at its closest. Yeah. You know, or no, 50 million miles, sorry. So yeah, more so about 100 million kilometers or something away. You know, and it's just driving around doing its thing and sending back these amazing photos, and yeah, it's incredible, absolutely incredible.
Awesome technology.
Yep.
What have we got next?
So 28th of April it is today.
Yeah.
And on the 28th of April 1926, exactly 100 years ago today, a certain guy by the name of Erwin Schrödinger wrote a letter to a certain guy by the name of Albert Einstein.
I know that one. Well, I know both of them.
And so, and this letter was ultimately, well, it's worth noting because it's the first time that the phrase wave mechanics was used. And so for those of you who are not aware of this, so 2026 is the centenary of a thing called the Schrödinger wave equation. And the Schrödinger wave equation is an extraordinary advance in what we call quantum mechanics, in the way that we understand the very, very small, the microscopic, the nanoscopic, okay? The way that we understand individual atoms, molecules, et cetera, because on the big scale, these things operate, shall we say, in ways that we can sort of predict and everything. But when we get down to the minuscule, then matter gets really seriously weird, and we have to start using quantum mechanics to be able to understand that, which is why quantum mechanics was a big, big, big thing. Okay, so it's the centenary of the Schrödinger wave equation, and the Schrödinger wave equation is an incredible equation because if we can solve the Schrödinger wave equation, we can basically know everything about everything.
Which seems like a great equation.
Which is really what scientists are trying to do, really. You know, we want to know everything about everything. And so the Schrödinger wave equation is a very, very, well, outwardly a very simple equation. It just looks like H psi equals E psi. That's it. And those of you with a little bit of knowledge of the Greek alphabet will know what those psis look like. But most importantly, what Schrödinger did was to introduce this thing called the wave function of a system. And the wave function is the thing that contains all of the information that we can know about a system, which basically is everything. And he came at this... he was working on this problem at the same time as Heisenberg was also working on the same problem of quantum mechanics. And the two actually came up with different treatments of the same thing. So Heisenberg came up with a thing called matrix mechanics, where he used matrices, which are mathematical constructs. And Schrödinger came up with the wave equation, the Schrödinger wave equation, so wave mechanics. So he came at it from the idea of the fact that all matter has got wave properties, okay? And because these waves have very, very, very small wavelengths, then the big effects sort of manifest themselves only on the very, very small scale. And so everything has an associated wave function, essentially. You, me, the cat. Funnily, we should mention cats there. But and the thing about the wave equation is that it does away with certainties in science. We like to think that science is certain. We like to think that we can get definite answers to all of our possible questions, as you could do with Newton and his three laws of motion way back in 1600 and whatever. And that was the thing. Newton's laws of motion said, right, you can predict the state of anything if you know its current state and you know these equations. And that's great, and it works sort of on the macro scale, but it doesn't work on the micro scale, which is where quantum mechanics comes in. And as I said, what then happens is that you start talking about probabilities, not certainties. So you don't know necessarily where things are. You know the probability of them being in a particular place at a particular time, but you can't definitely say it's there. You can say there's a 95% chance that it's there. Okay, and Einstein didn't in fact like this, and he he said that he didn't believe that God played dice, meaning that God wasn't a gambler, a sort of a probability sort of guy. But Schrödinger, most of you will have heard in relation to Schrödinger's cat. And so Schrödinger's cat, the whole thing is that you've got a cat in a box, and you've got it there with a radioactive sample, and when this radioactive sample decays, it's going to trigger a mechanism that opens a bottle of poison and the cat's going to die, okay? So radioactive decay is a totally random process, so we don't know when this is going to happen. And so we pack the cat off in the box with the radioactive thing, and then we sit and wait, okay? The box is closed, we can't see inside it, and the question then becomes, is the cat alive or dead? Mm. And the answer is we don't know.
Because okay? That would be certainty.
Aha. But, so so this is where this whole wave function thing comes in. And so essentially the box has got two wave functions. It's got a wave function where the cat is alive, and it's got a wave function where the cat's dead. So it's got these sort of two competing wave functions, which are both sort of coexisting, let's say, for want of explaining it any better. They sort of coexist, but then at the point where we open the lid and see if the cat's alive or dead, then the wave function of the box collapses into one of the two choices. Either you're alive or you're dead, okay? And this is the weirdness of quantum mechanics. And basically, the thing is, and this Einstein couldn't get over, is that the cat can be simultaneously alive and dead at the same time in the box. And that's one of the things, one of the many, many, many weird things about quantum mechanics. And there was a guy who came after this, his name was Everett, and he came up with the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. And he said that when you open the box, you create another universe. So you create two universes, one in which the cat's alive and one in which the cat's dead. So every possible situation like that, where you've got one of two possibilities, you start creating infinite universes, and these infinite universe, well, these, you know, these many universes all exist at the same time, except we can't see them anymore. It's all very, very weird stuff. But quantum mechanics is weird, and 100 years ago today was a sort of a big deal, I guess, in terms of quantum mechanics. It's cool stuff. I wish I could understand it.
Yeah, Schrodinger is one of those things where it's like I've known about it for a very long time. No idea what's going on. Maybe one day I'll fully be able to understand what he's on about. Or I should just ask him, what do you know?
Well, no, that's the thing. The great physicist, Richard Feynman, who won the Nobel Prize in Physics, he basically said that nobody understands quantum mechanics. So,
hey, yeah, that's a good place to start. what else have we got?
Okay, now this one, there are some things that sort of seem obvious in hindsight, I guess, but they still need to be studied. Because sometimes we get answers that we don't expect, let's say. So some workers in the UK and Austria asked the question, is education good for you? Does education prolong your life? Okay, is it good for your health, essentially? And so having come up with that question, they felt duty-bound to answer it. And so what they did is that they analysed a whole lot of mortality data across 13 countries in, where was it, Southeast Europe, Western Asia, and North Africa. And they did this for the period 1980 to 2015, so that's a good sort of 35 years or so. And they analysed those data by age and sex and education level. Okay, and here's a surprise. They found that on average, educated people would live 10 or up to 10 years longer. Okay, so education really is that good for you. And in particular, what they found that women aged 20 to 49, so it was particularly obvious over that range, okay, that cohort of people. And they had much, much, much lower mortality rates when educated than not. And so then obviously the question becomes, why should that be? Well, think about it. You know, you get educated, what's going to happen? You're going to get a better job, number one. You're going to have more money to maybe spend on things like health. You're going to have better access to healthcare because of that. You're going to very probably have better health knowledge because you've been educated. Okay, you know what's right and what all the crud floating around the internet is. And also being educated can change how people make decisions about their lives. You know, the mere fact that they've got this knowledge, just essentially it just improves their entire life. So, you know, obviously I'm in the education business and I'm a massive, massive advocate for education. I think that it's the absolute number one best thing that we can do for the entire populace is have everybody as educated as they can be. So, you know, that just really sort of backs that up, I think. So it really is no surprise, but now it's good that somebody's actually done the work. It's in the literature and people can quote it now. So yeah.
Yeah, every week my life gets longer doing Dear Science. Look, I'm learning a lot. Look, quantum mechanics, one day I'll figure it out. But
nicely done.
Thank you. Thank you, Alan, for joining us. Thank you, MOTAT, and thank you, Science. Aviation Conversations at MOTAT. Enjoy an evening in the Aviation Hall with a panel discussion exploring aerial mapping technology on the 30th of April. Book now at motat.nz.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
We'll be right back. Text in 5395 with any of your thoughts on these pieces.
Vera Allen's new album, Heaven Knows What Time, is an absolute stunner. So, we've made it our album of the week. That means we have copies of the vinyl to give away to lucky B-card holders. All you have to do is tune in religiously to 95BFM Breakfast all week and await the command to enter from the benevolent Rosetta and Millie. Heaven Knows What Time, the new album from Vera Allen, out this Friday via Flying Nun Records and where all good music is found. Crisp biscuits and fresh vegetables every Tuesday from 7 p.m. Replayed 4 a.m. Wednesday and always online at 95bfm.com. Check it.
Stinky Jim.
I believe in like the solar system. I believe in space. I really do believe in space.
Spaced Out. Josh Aoraki from Auckland Stardome Observatory and Planetarium talks everything spacey on Spaced Out. 4:40 every other Tuesday.
don't stay in the street. Lucky I don't shoot on the spot. Our bullets were made for men like you, the impotent idiots God forgot. Tonight you decide which corner takes residence, which room looms forever in your mind. But now you're on your own. We don't need men like you.
That was Welcome to Hell by Black Midi. Welcome back to The Wire on 95 BFM.
Children eat worms and bugs and all sorts of things when they crawl in around.
The Wire. It's time for our weekly catch-up with National MP Ryan Hamilton.
Last week, NZ First MP and Government Minister Shane Jones was criticised over using derogatory language towards Indian immigrants. These comments were condemned by the National Party and Christopher Luxon, who labelled NZ First's belief system as anti-immigrant and said Jones was scaremongering. This was not the extent of criticism between NZ First and National last week, however, with tensions between the two sparking after NZ First leader Winston Peters called Luxon out for not giving coalition partners prior notice of his confidence vote during a National Party caucus meeting last week. In turn, these comments have been dismissed, and Finance Minister Nicola Willis and Luxon have accused NZ First and Peters of putting Labour governments, like Ardern's, into power. Despite all this, however, Peters has insisted the coalition is as stable as a three-legged stool. Last week also saw the Treasury announce that they would revisit their forecasts for the economy ahead of the impending government budget. The government also announced some changes to the way infrastructure is run by the government, giving more power to the Independent Infrastructure Commission, increasing their oversight, and changing the way that ministers receive advice and information. This week, I spoke with National MP Ryan Hamilton about these developments, beginning with Shane Jones's comments. Last week, derogatory comments were made by Government Minister and NZ First Shane Jones towards immigrants. What is the government's stance on these comments?
We don't accept, you know, some of the language and the way they went about making those statements, obviously. We think you can have a difference of opinion around policy and process, but you can do it in a way that sort of preserves everyone's mama.
And looking particularly at Shane Jones as a prominent member of one of the coalition parties, does a potential kind of pattern of making certain comments affect at all the government's positions towards next election and going into a coalition?
Oh, I think we're a broad church. I mean, I think New Zealand has a pretty good idea of who Winston Peters is and Shane Jones, and, you know, they are essentially a populist party, and they, you know, have made some strong rhetoric around immigration and, you know, adjacencies around that. So I think their supporters will largely remain their supporters, and those on the fringe might reconsider their alliances, though. But I don't think as a coalition we can be, you know, wholly made responsible for each other. It's like, you know, essentially we're family, and you might not always agree with your mum or your dad or your brother, but as long as we can agree on the big rocks that take New Zealand forward.
Right, but going forward into, obviously for this current coalition government, you know, it's just about kind of getting through and working together. But looking forward towards next election, when you get to make these calls again about who you want to work with, will these comments and this rhetoric play a role in whether or not National will work with NZ First?
I think we're a broad church. I mean, those decisions are ultimately, you know, for the leaders of the party to work through. But I think, you know, we've got to be adults and appreciate we're going to have disagreements at the margin. And that we can have robust conversations and try and set the ground rules for what is and is not appropriate.
But I think at this stage of the election cycle, you're going to see a little bit of argy and bargy as, you know, the three parties on the right will try to win votes off each other effectively. So I think there'll be a little bit of that. But hopefully we can keep it in check.
Moving on slightly, last week NZ Frost leader Winston Peters criticised Prime Minister Christopher Luxon for not giving prior notice to his coalition partners that he was going to call a vote of no confidence at the National Caucus meeting. What is the government's stance on whether or not that was something that the Prime Minister needed to do?
Well, obviously that's National Party business, frankly, so I don't think it's appropriate for him to comment on National Party business and stuff which happens in each other's caucus. That's obviously highly confidential to the party.
And looking at comments made the other way, Prime Minister Christopher Luxon disavowed the comments made by Shane Jones's scaremongering, and Nicola Willis, importantly, called out Winston Peters for often kind of playing a kingmaker role that favoured the Labour government in coalition making. Are these things that the National Party is standing by?
I think all New Zealanders are wary of New Zealand First, and particularly those on the centre-right, where, you know, he supported a government with Jacinda Ardern in 2017. And, like I said, you know, as we get towards election time, all those nuances and distinctions are going to be made. They can be laid to bear, and ultimately the New Zealand public's going to have to choose who they trust to get on with the job.
Winston Peters also reassured Aotearoa last week that the coalition was as stable as a three-legged stool. Is that the stance kind of going into this final stretch before the election, that yes, this coalition is stable?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think we've shown, over 2.5 years, we've delivered. Sure, there's been, differences at different times, but that's all built into the agreements. The right to disagree, but still hold, government and reflect, at a respectful coalition. So certainly, I think New Zealand can be very comfortable that three parties know how to get on and govern.
Moving on, last week the Treasury moved to revisit their forecasts for the economy ahead of the upcoming budget. What does this revisiting actually mean? Why is this happening?
Oh, I think it's fairly obvious that the fuel crisis has made things a lot more challenging, and Treasury's got to, as does the Reserve Bank, obviously factor in short, medium, and long term implications. And the challenge, of course, with the fuel crisis is, it's multi-pronged. Like, we don't know how long this challenge will last for, and even if it ended quickly, there's still a long tail. But putting even the duration of it aside, there's the first, second order, third order complications of how it affects potentially shipping routes and industry, not directly, like, not just fuel and diesel and transport and everyday Kiwis, but the oil components of plastics and manufacturing and all those flow-on effects, what those implications might be, how restrictive they'll be on certain parts of the economy, and how that might drive up or impact on inflation. So there's a lot for them to consider and to weigh up, and obviously try and create a measured response too that can sort of see through the short term and still provide that monetary stability over the medium term.
And looking to the government specifically, how does the government kind of expect these revisited forecasts to influence plans going into this budget?
Obviously, it's very real. I mean, we've constantly said, we want to take those lessons from Treasury through the COVID period and offer targeted, timely and temporary responses rather than sort of broad brush policy. And we've got our budget, I think, literally in a month's time. And so it'll be having a real impact, I'm sure, on some of those policy announcements. It's a balance that we've got of maintaining fiscal discipline and, but trying to stimulate an economy, making sure we don't overcook scenarios or forecasts or undercook. So there'll be a real, obviously it's got to be a real marriage between the budget and fiscal policy and monetary policy as well. So it'll be very interesting over the next few weeks.
And finally, the government has moved to make changes to kind of shift where power and oversight lies for big infrastructure projects, moving a lot of the oversight to the Independent Infrastructure Commission. What is the government hope to achieve with these changes?
Well, one thing that I think governments over the last few decades are criticised of is trying to be more bipartisan on infrastructure readiness and commitments. And I guess this brings a bit of arm's length to the politics of it, where you've got an independent commission set up that's purely looking at, business case, financial costing, benefit, the benefit cost ratio, and trying to provide that, just that evidence-based analysis that government or ministers can pick up regardless of, which colour flag they fly. And I think that it's the biggest thing that our economy needs in terms of, long-term planning, because obviously a lot of, whether it's roading or bridges or, transport corridors, needs long-term planning. The companies required to deliver it have a lot of capital-intensive investment. So we are really trying to try and create a pathway forward for the next 10, 20, 30 years that, and it provides New Zealand too, that there's a little bit less political uncertainty in the room. Obviously, National had the Roads of National Significance in 2017. That got cancelled by the government, and then Labor government. And then when we got back in 23, we reinstated that. So I guess we're trying to avoid that flip-flopping and actually say, look, here's the big rocks that we can agree on, and let's have some independence to the process for the sake of, New Zealand's construction sector, the economy, and Kiwis.
And just kind of finally, how you mentioned it early on there, but how will this affect how ministers specifically kind of engage and interface with infrastructure?
Well, I think there's always going to be a political push to something if it's a particular, area of significance, like, say, a second harbour crossing or, something where there's a population density or strong demand for it. And normally with these types of things, there's a letter of expectations from the relevant minister and that sort of thing, which can give the organisation a bit of a steer. So there'll always be a degree of political noise. But by having that separation, like you have with the Reserve Bank or other government entities, it just creates a bit more of an independence and a chance for projects to stand up, on their own credentials rather than, political flavour of the day. So I think that's a really positive thing.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much. That was National Party MP Ryan Hamilton on Shane Jones and Winston Peters' comments last week, the Treasury revisiting forecasts and the infrastructure oversight changes.
That was our weekly chat with National MP Ryan Hamilton.
We'll be right back. Up next is Towers by Bon Iver.
Just to climb back, darling.
Welcome back to The Wire.
And I wish some of your dozy mates in the media had got a fix on their job and started being reporters and journalists, not editorialists and analysts, which they're not qualified to do. Prison captain, of course.
The Wire.
What's this button do? Whoa!
You are now entering the green world.
Since its inception in 2008, the New Zealand Emissions Trading Scheme, or ETS, has been, according to the government, its primary tool to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and tackle the climate crisis. As part of the scheme, the government sets a price for carbon units, which companies must pay to offset their emissions. The Commission highlighted that the scheme was not stable and susceptible to changes in the market, and did not have sufficient carbon units to last until 2030, requiring urgent reform. For Greenworld, I spoke with Scott Burnett, the Regional Conservation Manager for the Top of the South Island and Forest and Bird's climate spokesperson, about why Forest and Bird has called the system broken, what impact this has on Aotearoa, and what reforms should be implemented. So the Climate Change Commission recently gave advice on New Zealand's emissions trading scheme. What is the ETS and why is Forest and Bird saying it is a broken system?
Sure. Well, first of all, the ETS is New Zealand's primary tool for reducing emissions, and it seeks to do so by requiring people who pollute, businesses that pollute, to purchase ETS units for every tonne of CO2 they emit. They have to buy a unit, and the price of that is supposed to incentivize them to invest in lower emissions technologies or reduce their emissions. So every large polluting business in New Zealand is required to participate in the ETS, and households participate in it through things like, the price of fuel and the price of goods, ends up factoring in those ETS costs. The ETS, I guess, is supposed to create some revenue for the government. So the government holds auctions regularly, but in the last couple of years, of the last 10 auctions, 8 of them failed. And so the government didn't sell units and didn't earn any income from the ETS during that period. And so the Climate Commission is warning that the market is losing credibility and that market confidence has fallen, and they attribute that to the government's own decisions, which are making the system increasingly unworkable. And those decisions mostly relate to decisions outside the ETS, a whole lot of complementary measures that the government have chosen to roll back. That's things like deciding not to bring agricultural emissions into the ETS, abandoning plans to put any form of pricing on agricultural emissions at this point, weakening the biogenic methane target, reversing the ban on offshore oil and gas exploration, committing us to this new liquid natural gas terminal rather than putting more thought into alternatives, repealing the clean car discount, removing the vehicle efficiency standards, rolling back safety and climate measures by increasing speed limits. And then the Fast Track Act and RMA reform that removes the sort of core sustainable management pieces out of that legislation. And so all of those things collectively, create uncertainty to participants in the ETS that the government is serious about acting on climate change. And that creates that sort of market instability and loss of confidence.
Yeah, and what would this market instability sort of result in?
Yeah, so what it's resulting in is that with I guess a big problem with the emissions trading scheme is that the price that incentivizes people to plant exotic forestry for carbon income is lower than the price that is necessary to force businesses to reduce emissions or invest in, reducing their emissions. So it's cheaper for businesses to buy forestry carbon credits than it is to reduce their emissions. And so that current issue in the ETS is, you know, has driven a whole bunch of exotic afforestation in recent years, and it's problematic in that, you know, not necessarily the best land use decision in every case, and it is setting us up for future downstream problems where, you know, in 2050, where we've reached our emissions targets, there won't be ETS income for those forest owners. Do they end up with a stranded asset? Is it, you know, going to be filled with pests and weeds and, you know, creating fire risk and things like that? So, you know, those are some of the sort of unintended consequences of this scheme not working adequately.
Right. Has there been generally compliance with the whole carbon trading scheme?
Yeah, so every business that's required to participate in it does so. You know, I'm not aware of any issues there. I guess the one thing in this report that the Climate Commission has warned about, and it's not a new thing, they've warned about it previously in their advice to government, is that the emissions trading scheme is also on a trajectory toward failure, and that by the mid-2030s, there'll be such an oversupply of units in the market from forestry offsets and free allocation to industrial emitters that it just doesn't work anymore. And so, you know, it's beyond reasonable doubt that the ETS needs some reform to provide that confidence and create a pathway that gives some certainty to people who use fossil fuels and have to transition away from them so that they can make the appropriate investment decisions, you know, for their businesses.
Yeah.
And in a way, I guess, over the last couple of years, the government is relying on the ETS but has chosen not to do anything to fix the problems, and that's just sort of kicking the can down the road.
The government has stated in the past that the ETS is our primary tool to combat the climate crisis. If this tool is broken, what can we do? What are the alternative methods to mitigating greenhouse gas emissions?
Yeah, so the ETS can be fixed, and it also needs, you know, we can't just rely on the ETS alone. At the moment, the government are giving a free pass to agriculture. Agriculture is responsible for 53% of New Zealand's emissions currently, and by relying solely on the emissions trading scheme, that puts more pressure on industry and transport and other sectors of the economy to carry the weight. Cabinet saw advice from officials last year that warned that covering that free pass to agriculture could add $270 a year to the average household's budget in New Zealand. So in effect, you know, you're asking the average New Zealander to pay for those agricultural emissions through extra costs and from having transport and industry, you know, carry more of the load. We think that's not fair. and it's also, you know, all of this stuff is not adequately, you know, treating climate change like the emergency that it is. You know, Forest and Bird, we're very keenly aware that 75% of our birds, our freshwater fish, our reptiles are all threatened with extinction or at risk of becoming threatened with extinction. And climate change is really exacerbating those pressures. And so climate change is something we can do something about, and we need to be doing it.
Yeah. And the ETS has been around since 2008, and a 2016 Ministry of Environment report suggested that it had marginal effects on reducing CO2 emissions. Is the ETS effective in reducing our carbon emissions?
I guess you could argue yes, in that the country currently is on track to meet its emissions reduction targets. There's, you know, it looks like it is less certain the further out we get, and that, you know, the government need to make decisions now so that we can achieve the future budgets. But right now we are on track. But we would argue that the reason we're on track is because we've had COVID, We've had a high inflationary period. Things like the current Strait of Hormuz thing are all kind of creating economic headwinds. And so we're in this thing that in economics is known as demand destruction. Emissions have plateaued or are dropping because businesses are closing, production stalling, and households are struggling with those high costs, and not because the government is successfully managing our transition to a clean, low emissions future. And so it could work, it can work, it just needs reform. And it needs a bunch of complementary measures, things like reinstating the clean car discount, for example. Those sorts of things that the government had rolled back, you know, were helping us achieve that emissions lowering pathway. And at Forest and Bird, you know, we think that we need to drastically reduce emissions across transport, agriculture and industry, and that doing so is the most responsible response to climate change. And then at the same time, we also need to be investing in nature-based solutions like restoring our wetlands, native afforestation, to build up climate resilience. And in doing so, that would help protect people, our communities, and our biodiversity. I guess one final thought here is that reducing emissions and investing in climate resilience is a better investment than spending money after each and every more frequent weather event. You know, that the costs of climate change, you know, are being keenly felt by households and by the government, and that the faster we can build resilience and reduce our emissions, the better we can manage those weather events.
That was Scott Burnett from Forest and Bird, speaking about the Climate Change Commission's recent report on the emissions trading scheme.
That was The Green World.
I'm tired of
That was Cacophony by Fables.
Ooh!
The Wire.
Last week on Thursday at 8:51 a.m., a student by the name of Benjamin Law sent out an email to a mailing list that appeared to contain every student enrolled in an undergraduate course at the University of Auckland. What followed were 15 minutes of recurring emails with recipients using the reply all function to notify everyone else of their confusion, their dismay, or simply to plug their social media. By 9:06 a.m., when emails stopped functioning, a total of 413 emails were sent to all of the students on the mail list. To discuss how such an email got sent and how the problem got fixed, Thursday Wire host Caden spoke to the person behind the original email, Benjamin Law.
Do you want to start by just introducing yourself?
Yeah, my name is Benjamin. I obviously sent that email. I don't know what else to say.
And you're a student at the university, obviously.
Yeah, in my final semester of commercial law.
Oh, congratulations. So firstly, the question I have is why? What was your goal when you sent the email out this morning?
There was really no goal. I didn't actually expect it to go to everyone. Like, I assumed the university would have not let the email go through. Like, usually they're set up so that only the certain people who manage it can, like, email the mailing list. So when I logged onto Google Groups, I sent the header test because I didn't think it would actually go through, right? And then when it did, that's when I rang up the university and it was like, this is what happened, this is how to fix it, yeah. But I feel like the issue is kind of like, it's been sitting there for a while because I remember on Reddit seeing someone said that the group has existed since, like, 2022. And it, like, could have been a lot worse if someone malicious kind of used that, you know?
Yeah, well, actually, that links to my next question, which is how did you get access to the list? And does it show a weakness in the university's IT setup?
No, I think it was just a little bit of a misconfiguration because, like, I've worked at other companies and usually when you're using Google software, you use, like, Google Groups and stuff. And, like, the Tramping Club uses Google Groups so that you can see all the emails that are sent to the list and things like that. But it's properly set up so that only the people who are sending the newsletters can actually send to the group. So if you just log into, like, groups.google.com with your uni email address, it'll show up right there. But because they had misconfigured the configuration, it would let anyone send an email to it instead of just university staff. Yeah.
What kind of feedback have you gotten since you sent the email?
It's been quite mixed, obviously. A lot of people are quite angry, and I do feel quite bad for that. And I was quite scared that, like, I would get in trouble, and I still obviously am. But then I think as I've gone throughout the day, a lot of people have just been making jokes about it, which has kind of made me a little bit less anxious and feel a little bit less bad. But
so have you heard from the university at all since you sent the email?
I don't think I've heard from anyone officially reaching out for, like, any investigation or anything, but I did get an email from someone who I think was a communications analyst asking why I sent the email and who authorized it, and I kind of just replied back and I was like, I don't know, I didn't actually mean it to go like that. And then I kind of told them it was misconfigured and that I've already spoken to IT about it.
That was University of Auckland student Benjamin Law on the email chain he started to every University of Auckland student on Thursday.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a rātou I kōrero mai ki maua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Tuesday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Professor Alan Blackman, National MP Ryan Hamilton, Forest and Bird spokesperson Scott Barnett, and student at the University of Auckland, Benjamin Law. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana, thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up, we've got The Wonderful with Jin.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.